Darren doesn't really need any introduction, but for those of you who don't know the full range of his work, he is the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at Oxford University, and previously at Sheffield University. And he's author of, just published this year, a book on one of the kind of key issues of kind of division and issues that the political class don't address, the housing crisis. In the book All That Is Solid, How the Great Housing Disaster Defined Our Times. And before that, you may know books like Injustice, Why Social Inequality Matters, which is a really, to my mind, a book that really supplements works like The Spirit Level by Wilkinson and Pickett, but it actually has a much deeper grasp about the issue of politics, ideology and choice. And also because he is so prolific, coming out just after our vote, sadly, on September the 25th, is Inequality and the 1%. Now, Danny's actually, not intervened, that's the wrong phrase, but contributed to the Scottish debate in many ways from that writing, and also he was involved in a book that I was involved in called After Independence last year, where he wrote about if Scottish independence is just about independence and staying where we are, it's really not worth the paper it's written on. And interestingly, we were just having a chat about the issue of The Guardian, which has written some really dire stuff on our debate. And Danny was the subject of a Guardian editorial praising him a couple of years ago. He informed me, was just after the paper, this is 2010, just after the paper came out, made that really wise choice of coming out for the Lib Dems in the 2010 election. And it said about him that he is that rare thing. He's an expert, he's politically engaged, and he's able to explain simply why the subject and inequality matters to us all. So without further ado, I give you Danny Dorgan. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks very much for inviting me. I'm an academic, I'm a geographer, so I'm going to show you some maps. I've been interested in the independence debate from the point of view of England, of what might happen to England, what could happen to England. And I've been increasingly, what's a very English word, disappointed. That's the word people on the right use when they're very, very, very angry. But I've been disappointed about the lack of a debate or much commentary within England about what's going on. What you tend to get are journalists based in London who are Scottish, who are interested in it writing, and the same for academics. And then finally, there's an academic who wrote a piece, which I didn't agree with, but I sent him an email congratulating him and he bothered, and saying it's great to see somebody who isn't Scottish getting involved in this. And he had sent me an email back saying, actually, even though his surname wasn't obviously Scottish, he was. And I think it shows what the mood in England and amongst the English establishment is, which is, you're not going to vote yes, and even if you did vote yes, it wouldn't matter very much for you. That is the impression I get. I suspect if you did vote yes, it could have a very big effect on England. These things are completely unpredictable, what the effect would be, but there are ways, if you're romantic, if you're imagining it could have a good effect on England, and I'll get towards that in the end. So maps, we draw stretch maps, so this is what the United Kingdom looks like in terms of people, and those are the votes that matter in Scotland and where they are. Here we are in Europe. Again, we stretch Europe so you can see those lovely Scandinavian nations are all very lovely, but they are relatively small. If you're looking at the population of Europe, that makes you concentrate on the places that matter. We have no control over how these maps come out. We just take the population and plug it into a computer program and it stretches it to produce what you get. This sometimes has unfortunate results. my colleague Dr. Hennig here last night won an award at the Cartography Society for this particular map. And here we have another country, Japan. Japan is rather like the Scandinavian countries in terms of the degree of solidarity and equality that goes on in Japan, but 130 million people. And we never talk about Japan. We never put Tokyo up as a kind of city that we should look at for, a city that works, where the transport works, where there is very, very little crime. According to the Foreign Office, the most likely bad thing to happen to you in Japan if you're a tourist is that you lose your passport by yourself. And that's the highest number of recorded incidents. We tend to look to the United States as a guide, which is not good if you're interested in equality. And we don't tend to look to mainland Europe. I didn't draw this particular diagram, but I think it really sums up how the UK is run, where the money is, what matters in terms of how the elite and the establishment think. Each circle there is a city. If you look very carefully, you'll see Glasgow and Edinburgh there. And each circle is sized by the value of residential dwellings in that city. It's now, it's a year old, it's actually almost 2 years old, and you have to add 200 billion to that middle circle because of the boom that's currently going on in London and South East in prices. This is an incredibly unequal set of nations. Here's another way of looking at the housing boom. We've just taken all the London boroughs and made them the size of the increase in property value. And you'll see that London as a whole has had a bigger increase in value than the whole of the North East, the North West, and your Riverside put together, no Wales or Scotland in this area. There's something going on which is quite extreme, which is of course being talked down and saying, oh, don't worry, it'll calm down, it'll slow down. But what you're getting, as I'll show you a bit later, at the moment in the South East of England, is people desperately trying to buy a house, a very small house, if they can, and the number of people can buy houses, of course, is going down and down and down, because they think that if they can't buy a house now, they will for the rest of their lives be a tenant, which in most cases means a private tenant, because we now have more people renting privately than renting off councils or housing associations. And we're heading back towards that period before the Second World War, when the majority of the population is renting and the landlords control what they can do. These figures were produced by the estate agent Savills. We live in very strange times. Savills actually getting slightly concerned about the extremes of inequality and how they're rising, and they were reported in the Financial Times. Landlords have made an absolute killing in the last 10 years, particularly since the crash, because people at first were not able to buy when there was a crash, so they rented. Then when property prices rise, the value of landlords' property rises, they use all the rents to buy more houses, so if you're trying to get a home in the southeast of England, you're competing with landlords. Here's the same thing shown another way. As you see, I'm going to focus about England, I'm simply not qualified to talk about the debate in Scotland, but I'm interested about what's wrong with England, and what, if there was a yes vote, would that have an effect on England? What would it be like? Would it just be shrugged off, or would there be some soul searching to be done? And how can one part of a larger union decide that it doesn't really want the supposed trickle down and the wealth creators and so on. It wants to be out of this. And there's many more implications. For one thing, if you begin almost a day after the referendum, if there was a yes vote, people who trade in currencies will have to take another look at sterling. Because if sterling is only backed up by the assets south of the border, you have to remember, all these assets, 60% of our total wealth, is just our residential property. And it's not that this residential property is that much different from what it was 50 years ago. It isn't that these houses that cost £2 or 3 million are actually £2 or 3 million objects. It's fictional. So if you take the oil out, how safe do the finances of England look? How safe does the whole thing look? If you have to defend sterling, you have to raise interest rates. What happens if you raise interest rates by 0.5% or by 1%? I'll get onto that a bit later. But let's want to give you more of an image of what I think as well. This is a very old cartoon that's produced in the Pledge Journal. If you simply add two noughts, you can turn it into a modern-day cartoon. You probably make at least one of the figures female. And if you have any suggestions for what you do for the hats that could update it, I'd be grateful. But we do have people sitting at the bottom. We have a soup kitchen coming back in since 2008 in very large numbers. To give you the summary of how it's really worked, most people have stepped down. The Institute of Fiscal Studies shows that there's been an increase in equality of income since 2008 that has got us back to 1991 levels for the UK as a whole, as long as you miss out the top 1%. As long as you miss out the top 1%, the top 1% have carried on soaring upwards. And you've got to ask yourself, what would it take to stop that? What would it take to stop rising inequality? And I keep on saying in England. The last time inequality fell was around about 1913, 14, 15, 16, 17. That was the kind of turning point. Ireland leaving certainly didn't make the rest of the United Kingdom a less radical place. We had decade after decade of rising inequality from that period through to the end of the 1970s. And half of the increase in inequality we got between incomes occurred before 1939. But now we're going in the opposite direction. To be in the top 1%, if you haven't got any kids, and there's two of you, it's £160,000 a year. You tell people in London this, they say, what, so low? Household income as low as 160? Because people, affluent people in London, are used to higher incomes because, of course, in London, far more than 1% of the population are in the 1% because 1% is so crowded there. These graphs show the proportion of income that the top 1% have taken historically in a series of countries. I didn't pick these countries. All countries were pretty unequal around the time of the First World War. In all of them, equality increased. Around the time of the First World War, the best off 1% were taking a quarter of all income. That's the time of state towns and servants and so on. By the time you get down to the 1980s and 1970s, at least in the UK, the top 1% has taken about 6% of all income. Now the top 1% in the UK has got back up to around about 15% or 10% after tax. But if you look at the Netherlands, you'll see you can have a very different story. There's a new figure which isn't shown there for 2012. I think which says the Netherlands, the top 1% taking about 6 or 7% of all income. I think the top 1% really matter. It's not just it's a very simple statistic. It's that the cleavage in British society has now opened up between the 1% and the 99%, because the rest of the top 10% have actually seen their incomes fall. Partly because, of course, the rest of the top 10%, they're not affected by that tax cut. They were never paying the top rate of tax. They've had their child allowance taken off and so on. If you're in the 1%, you don't often bother to collect child benefits because it doesn't make much difference to your income. Here's a little graphic just showing you wealth distribution, a way of looking at the unequalness of wealth in the country. We are one of the most unequal countries in the world. Wealth is very hard to measure, as Thomas Piketty has found out recently. But this just gives you an idea about how unequal we are. But you can become more unequal than this. And the more unequal than this is the United States. This isn't my graphic, it's produced by a professor in New York. And the date for the graphic is 2007. And the reason the date is 2007 is that by 2010, about 40% actually had negative wealth. They were in the Atlantic. And that really gets politicians scared, because if you've got 40% of your population with absolutely nothing to lose, you can have serious problems. If you included their residential wealth in that, it got even worse, because the bottom 40% had negative equity. It's now gone back up to that kind of picture. Britain is one of the favoured places for the super rich of the world to live. The favoured places are the United States, London and Singapore, the places where people with lots of money feel safe to be. And this is a graph from the United States showing that there's a very nice correlation between how much those at the top take, how big their share is, and how much deregulation you get, how much they manage to get laws changed to help them maintain and keep that share. The most extreme statistics on this are the top bankers' pay statistics. We have something like 2,200 bankers who are paid over €1 million a year. The next highest number is in Germany, where it's 197. If you take all the top paid bankers of the rest of Europe together, they don't get up to our level. Or in Owen Jones' new book, my favourite little stat from that, if you compare Japan to Barclays Bank, Barclays Bank pays more people over £1 million pounds a year than are paid in the whole of Japan. In Japanese society, they have the highest life expectancy in the world. We are incredibly extreme. Why are bankers so highly paid? Because they're used to US norms. They fly back and forth from New York to London. Another graph about wealth inequality. The Office of National Statistics accidentally released this data and then rescinded it and said it's unreliable because they don't know the wealth of the top 1%. That's probably a conservative estimate, to be honest, if you look at the super rich list. And just a few more graphs, and then I'll get back to a bit of politics. This is showing the proportion of households in England who are now renting with children, households with children who are now renting privately. And you'll see this incredible rise since 2008. So a quarter of households, which is a quarter of families who've got kids in England, are now renting from a private landlord, which has suddenly happened. And the reason it suddenly happened is that these families don't have as much money as couples without children. So they can be outbid by the childless, if you like. And the tragedy you're beginning to get in the southeast of England is families being moved on and on and on again, because the landlord can get somebody who can pay slightly higher rent. So kids are having to swap school again and again and again, and they're losing their friends again and again. And this is very sudden, the big rise is very sudden. I don't think it was planned, we can debate about that. What's amazing is the acquiescence to this in England. Almost absolute acquiescence. I'm renting privately because I didn't try hard enough and I didn't get a good enough job that would let me not do that. No realisation that your chances of being able to be a bit steadier have gone down. No memory. Really, no memory left that we have rent controls and rent regulations all the way from the First World War through to the 1980s. There's an acquiescence in the southeast of England. This is the kind of thing that concerns me, which I think is very different from, well, I know it's very different from what you get up here. Example is housing rights. The law's being changed here to mean that people intervening and renting your house cannot rip you off and charge you various things. The Labour Party in England will not even consider suggesting implementing the laws that have been put in Scotland to protect private tenants because they don't want to interfere with the market. That's the kind of statement. If people tell you this is inevitable, and you're told in England and in London this is inevitable, it's a global race, all can be more unequal, you just want to live a bit, and if you're lucky you can get the trickle down from the rich, you need to look at these amazing socialist countries of the Netherlands and Switzerland. Just to see how you can control the 1%. The 1% will always have the most, by definition, and they will always be small, by definition. But there's no need for them to take 15% of it. It can gradually go down. There's the housing one. Oh, just got the map in of a relatively small country that seems to operate quite well. And there's 1% getting poorer in those two countries. And a little map of Switzerland for you. Top tax rates progressively come down in more unequal countries. And as the country becomes more unequal, the top tax rates come down, and the tax on people at the bottom rises, and you increase VAT, you increase a whole series of things that are crazy taxes. Like the cost of fuel, you have to pay for fuel. And that's an effect of the flat tax. I'll just leave that there for Western Spain. It's a complicated one. But it's just about how dire the situation is in the United States for pensioners. I think it's very interesting if you take this debate and the polls in Scotland, that the one group who is solidly no are the over 60s. Because they think that by voting no, your pension will be safe and your savings will be safe. And you have to look, if the UK comes on the list trajectory towards becoming like the USA, that's how safe your pensions are. Only a tiny number of pensioners are okay. Fewer and fewer people have private pensions. The collective pensions arrangements that they are being undermined. I'm in a university pension scheme. That is progressively being changed over what I might eventually get if I get to talk. Because of course the money is gambled on the stock market. We occasionally have brave statements made by people like the Children's Commissioner, who I think lost their job shortly after making this statement, but about who is being hit the hardest. But it's a minority thing really in England, talking about who's being hit the hardest. And we get these kinds of graphs, complicated graphs produced by the Institute of Fiscal Studies, but they're kind of glossed over in the debate. The only reason, by the way, that the richest there get richer is that 1% of income. The other 9/10 haven't. But the 1% have got so much better off that it drags the average up from the top 10%. People don't like inequality. This is a Mommy poll taken around the world, almost everywhere, apart from the United States, almost everywhere, a majority are against the degree of inequality. There isn't an obvious pattern to the ranking of those countries, but just being against inequality doesn't get you away from inequality. Apologies, I think we're getting towards the end of the complicated graphs. This is one on housing, and I'll just explain this one because I do think it matters. That top line is comparing the number of rooms per person in the property that the best of 10 people live in compared to the worst of 10 at each census since 1911. So in 1911, the best of people had 4 times more rooms per person in their homes than the worst of 10. We had real crowding, real overcrowding in 1911. That hit a peak in 1921, and this is what 60, 70 years of progressive efforts get you. And then we got down to the inequality being 3 times as many rooms. So that was the achievement. The achievements of greater equality are often pretty small. Another good example might be what the Labour government did over education. Labour government did do some things about education that made it more equal in the South. It had the effect of increasing the proportion of children from the poorest of the homes who got to go to university. That effect was 1 extra child in a classroom of 30 got to go to university. And that was hated by people who don't think their children should have gone. And at the end, after the 1980s, you suddenly see this. It's an incredible rise in inequality of households per room. Part of it is aging. Part of it is a good news story. Our housing stock was designed for us to die in our 70s. And then very efficiently give it to another family. If you live into your 80s and 90s and you don't live home, but it's not just that, this is rising wealth inequality and rising income inequality. This is my favourite graph, it's a Piketty graph, and it's showing you the change since 1960 in the top rate of tax in various countries. Switzerland, top rate of tax stays the same. The rich don't have to pay high rate of income tax, but in the countries where the 1% have increased their take the most, that's the increase of the 1%, they've got the top rate of tax down by 40%. often confused. You don't have a high top tax rate because you want to bring in lots of money. What a rate of 60 or 70% does, say over earnings £200,000 a year, is it stops a young, greedy man, almost always a man, working for a bank, asking for a massive pay rise, because they won't get most of that money. People make a mistake of thinking that having high top tax rates is about making money, isn't it? We have very low top tax rates, but a third of all our income tax comes from the 1% because they pay themselves so much. I like this quote because I've read it, just have to move back home to Oxford, about Oxford-run Britain. It's an example of, I think, a Scots based in London talking about what's going on. The insularity of England, the way in which people have gone to only one or two universities, done the same course, PPE has got a lot to answer for. It's a very, very small, tight-knitted group. We have a kind of similar mindset about what people are told and what they think is possible. I thought I should put in an example. I'm not being that flippant because I didn't think for a bit, but an example of one thing that England does better than Scotland. So I've got this for you. This is a proper 20 mile an hour zone. Okay, so I've got the... This is a 20 mile an hour zone that means you're not allowed to drive more than 20 when there are children playing in the streets. And this is a bad 20 mile zone that's advisory. Right? There's probably more than that I can give you. It's not all one way, but as the South has become more dog-eat-dog and so on, it is hard to find things where you say, couldn't you learn from this for 5 years? It is good. I'm a southerner, I've worked in the South, I've gone back to the South, I kind of like the South. But the South I see is a nastier and nastier South of England. And very different, of course, from the North of England. I live 10 years in Newcastle, 10 years in Sheffield. You get very different attitudes still there. So to wrap up, I think we need to worry about extreme rates of inequality in the top 1%, the 0.1%, the 0.01%. I'm not the only person who thinks this. President Obama had it last year as one of his two major agenda items. The President of China had it as one of his two major agenda items. The Pope had it in his Easter address. The businessmen who meet in Davos came up with 30 problems, major problems the world was facing. And the top three were climate change, income inequality, and unemployment. So even they had it here. When you look at those numbers from Oxfam, which Forbes magazine said had got out of date almost as fast as Oxfam published them, we're seeing something that is out of control and which London is actively courting to bring in these people to supposedly get the trickle down from them or the jobs from them. You need something to protect yourself from this. Otherwise, you are likely to end up being badly and insecurely housed. You are likely to pay a very high proportion of your wage or salary to rent. Almost all of it will go to make somebody else richer because they're not spending the rent building a house for you or doing it up. The quality of property is appallingly bad that's being rented. And if you want to get even scary about what's happening, if it carries on going in this direction, and you have a couple of children, one of your children could become a servant for somebody who's very rich. Because one of the major ways in which the job opportunities rise, particularly in London, when you get a concentration of people with such high amounts of money, is that they need cleaners, they need people to look after their kids, they need gardeners. There's a whole range of occupations. Camelot produced reports about lottery winners. And of course, they're always trying to talk up the National Lottery. One of their reports showed that the average lottery winner of a large amount of $1 million creates 6 jobs, including their personal beautician. And this is extreme to say, but that is where we are heading towards. So, friends, I'm going to get back to the independence debate. These are long-run trajectories. things changed around about the time of the First World War for a whole set of reasons. One was the only way you could find money to fight the war was to tax the very rich, so taxes went up. Another very important one was that the Russian Revolution got people scared at the top. They were very scared that they could end up being shot as well, and they behaved slightly nicer to people beneath them. That set in train, and the Second World War helped, but set in train the change in behaviour, the change of seeing other people as human, and a switch away from the most popular, the mode of job for women being working in service around about 1913, to a point in the 1960s and 70s where you've never been more equal. The 70s have been written down in a terrible way. In the 1970s, in the city of Sheffield, when I lived there, I looked at the data, Sheffield actually had a mortality rate which was just below the national average. Life was that good in Sheffield for the first time. It then switched again in the 1970s, and you can argue endlessly about why it switched. But since then, we've had rising and rising inequality. It takes a big event to switch it. Now, a yes vote might not be that big event, but the yes vote from the point of England is really interesting. Because the UK has a debt which is similar in proportion to the debt of Greece. It just has to be paid back over a longer time. What happens when people begin to inspect the books of two countries as they're beginning to split up? What happens when you get people looking in more detail at what the actual assets are and what they're worth? What happens when you get a squabble about what is a pretty small currency? The thing I'll end on, because I know you want to ask questions about this, was do you remember the four days of discussion so well when the coalition government was being formed and why they were told to hurry up? Because they couldn't discuss for too long. And the reason Gus O'Donnell, the cabinet secretary, I think, told them to hurry up was that there was a fear there was going to be a run on sterling. Now in fact there was a run on the euro, because you can't do things. Sterling is a small, not well backed up, particularly dodgy little currency. If you have a battle over it, and you're trying to divide up the family silver, in a country where there isn't actually much family silver because we have such a large debt, all of that makes the way in which we sell ourselves to the world as being a safe place, and a place with good banks and bankers that can be trusted, that begins to become undermined. I honestly think if there was a yes vote, I think Scotland would be okay. I think things could be very, very turbulent for England because it would be a big jump in the slow and steady change in England from being the most powerful country in the world a century ago, the biggest empire, towards slowly, grudgingly, very, very difficultly becoming a normal European country. And one of the things that would speed it up would be the inspection and the soul-searching that would have to occur in the aftermath of what would be an almighty shock. Because almost nobody sat at the board and thinks it's going to happen. And it may well not happen, but they really don't think it's going to happen at all. I can't predict what the Prime Minister would have to do. I can't predict how the parties would be fined and so on. There'd be a lot of blaming. But I just think you need to look at the finance. You need to look at what creates funds on banks. What creates confidence? If you are moving money around the world and you want a safe place to put your money in free-flowing capital markets, in the aftermath of a yes vote, would you be wanting to leave your money in the UK when you weren't sure it's going to happen? Or would you press a button and just move it somewhere a bit safer in October or November or December of this year? And I just think people should talk about that, that there is absolutely no discussion at all about what might happen to England. And I don't think it would necessarily be bad, but I think it would be turbulent and difficult, and it would shake people up a lot. Thank you very much for your patience. Please think of some questions for me.
Thank you very much. I can speak loudly. Not necessarily. necessarily a question, but a couple of thoughts. You keep saying the debt or the proportion of the debt that Scotland might owe and so on. I think the proper term for that has to be the alleged debt. And I think that the way that the mechanism of having a privately owned central bank or more or less privately owned central bank is not necessarily a bad mechanism, but the central bank needs to be publicly owned. And if it's privately owned, then it's an alleged debt, I think. And if Scotland were to vote yes, it seems to me that Scotland needs to be looking at and could have a huge impact on the wider world if we decided to have either a publicly owned central bank, like North Dakota has in the United States, and or something like that. And the woman Ellen Brown, who is from the Institute of Public Banking, and whose book Web of Debt is also very, very interesting, was here in November 2012. And she did point out that there is a fund, which I think used to be part of Scottish Enterprise, which could be used to provide credit for investment in infrastructure and business at very low interest rates here in Scotland.
Thank you for that. If you were to construct a bank of the UK, yeah, which have, just the process of doing that would change things and change that in a more way. Over the alleged debt, there's a huge problem with money at the moment in that in the year after 2008, housing values, which is again I say the majority of our wealth in Britain, housing values did plummet. The country became a tenth less, yeah, and that was all paper money. The worth of all these banks, how much was RBS, how many times the whole of the UK was RBS worth? It's all based on sentiment and the idea it's all, you know, things are steady, it's okay. It can crumble very, very fast. I mean, I was saying earlier to Jerry, I have a suspicion, and I've never mentioned it, but I have a suspicion that Alistair Darling was so scarred by opening that paper on holiday in the Scottish Islands and suddenly finding out that the banks were crashing when he was Chancellor. And they're being involved and actually seriously worrying about will the cash points not work. I think that particular experience means where he is now because he thinks this will be safer. But the whole thing isn't safe. And it relies on people not thinking about it too much and an idea of certainty, and a yes vote would pop that little bubble quite quickly. Who's got the mic?
Hi, thanks. I'm concerned that you've only mentioned England.
Yeah.
The UK is comprised of four countries. Scotland, I think, has been forgotten by most people in England. You know, and I've found that particularly since I've moved here years ago. But what happens to Wales and Northern Ireland? They're relatively poor countries. And is England concerned about that? Is the UK concerned?
About that. I talked a little bit about England because I am there and it means one particular thing. My impression from looking at data is that Wales and England are increasingly integrated in various ways, not least massive migration, which is increasing between the two. Although migration is increasing in general, so everybody's moving further. So the number of English people in Scotland is going up, the number of Scottish people in Wales is going up, but Wales and England are getting tighter and tighter and tighter in various ways. Northern Ireland has been largely forgotten since the Good Friday Agreement, so as long as it's not too much trouble, it doesn't get much reporting. If you just take housing again, which is the thing I know about, the value of housing plummeted in Northern Ireland along with what happened in the rest of Ireland. That was completely ignored because English policy, you can call it national policy, but it's English policy, is entirely about the southern English housing market. And this is not just the Conservatives. The bulk of all the spending that Osborne's done has been to keep the housing market up. He's actually spent money in each budget. I think he's risked well over $100 billion on Help to Buy. If house prices come down, the first 20% they come down, we have to cover the drop in anybody with a Help to Buy mortgage. That's what those things are. But this began the year before the Conservatives and Liberals came into power. In their last year in office, New Labour halved the budgets for regional development and took the money from that and put it into the mortgage rescue package to hold house prices in the southeast up. Because they saw what was happening in Madrid and in Greece and in Portugal and Iceland and Ireland and almost every other part of Europe that far from Berlin, if you want to put it very crudely. But one reason about England, policies about England, is in fact really about half of England. And the underlying theory is, if you look after this part of England, the better off people in London and the home counties, the rest can be subsidised from the supposed wealth generation of that group. That's the kind of underlying rationale I often hear from both sides of politics.
Hello, I'm
Jane
Hughes. I write about rented housing, and I noticed I write more about the personal experience of it. And what the insecurity of renting does, it makes people scared, it makes people terrified. And there's one thing that I'm a radical independent supporter, but I don't think anyone's saying enough about the insecurity of renting. There is more social housing in Scotland, but people are still treated, you're still 2 months away from the streets. And it will be worse in England because the letting agents will not be controlled. I just wondered, what would be your optimum idea for renting? I've read your book, you have some things to say about it.
Okay. We just don't get this right. We talk a lot about precarious employment. You know, people no longer have jobs and lives, you're precariously employed, you go from one to another. And that causes people to flood into London, because London's meant to be a safe place to be. If you lose your job, you can get others. We don't talk about being precariously housed. But so many people are prepared to go, including large numbers of the mortgage. Because the idea of a mortgage, which you're going to spend 25 years paying instead of you're paying every month, you can't do that with precarious employment. So many, many people start mortgages and fail to get them. Another example is this big campaign for living wage. What's the point of getting the living wage if your rent's going up that fast? If you see what I mean? The groups in London who are arguing for the living wage, I'm just beginning to cotton on, they're not going to win anything if the rent's going up faster than their gains on that. My kind of very timid suggestion is that almost anything would help. Almost anything. So, I don't know, making it so that you have to have at least 6 months' notice, if not a year's notice. You can argue about what would be ideal. Ideally, I'd like five. Almost anything would help, because it would help to burst the bubble of people with money buying as many houses as they can to become the landlords of the future, if you have an idea. And what's really sad about this is I'm not waving utopian ideas at you. This is just what happens in Germany, all Switzerland, all France, all the Netherlands, let alone Scandinavia, all Greece. In Greece, you cannot be evicted from your house if it's your main property and it's worth less than €300,000 by law. Or Ireland.
California has rent controls.
Yeah, and New York has rent controls. What's really sad politically about these things is this isn't an exciting politics for the English one. This isn't a, you know, couldn't we do that? Wouldn't it be better? We could go forward. It's why have we lost the ability to look at what people do in normal countries? If you take the 25 richest countries in the world, we were the fourth most unequal, we're probably now the third most unequal. The most unequal is the United States and Singapore. Netherlands is the average country. And I would just look to what they do in the Netherlands. It's not a utopia, but people are generally much better housed, they feel more secure, they don't work as long hours as we do, but they're better paid and their children happen to be the tallest on the planet.
Hi, Danny. Yeah, thanks for coming to Glasgow and educating people about inequality. but basically, my question basically was, I'm kind of concerned about the people of England after what I've heard and read about as well. And do you think a solution towards it down in England would be devolution? Because it's helped Scotland over the years, Wales and Northern Ireland. Do you think devolution in different parts of England could possibly be a solution? Because, you know, as you were saying in your speech there, that there's different attitudes over the north, the central belt, and the south.
Yeah.
So, do you think that people have their own say to reduce inequality towards equality a way forward?
It's not necessarily needed. If you take the case of Japan, there is a devolution in Japan, but you've got a very large country that's very equal. And the attempts in the northeast went so badly wrong, I think it's going to be a long time before somebody does something. I'm much I think the rest of England needs to take control of London and what's being allowed to go on in London and say it doesn't want a few Londoners to be allowed to behave in this way. I say one thing about inequality in Glasgow as I'm here with my accent. You always hear, of course, statistics about poverty in Glasgow and life expectancy and how bad things were, and still are, but some have actually got a bit better since devolution, interestingly. You always hear that. What you rarely hear is about how the overall life expectancy of Scotland is only a year below England's. And the reason it's only a year below England's is there are also lots of parts of Scotland and lots of bits of the edge of Glasgow with remarkably high life expectancy. And from remarkably wealthy parts, Scotland has an inequality, a rate of inequality, that is similar to England's without those super rich people in London in there. And so I shouldn't be lecturing about inequality, but I'm always amazed that you don't have TV programmes that go to bed then or will die, or, you know, and actually talk about these areas which are in some ways as posh and as rich as parts of the home county. And if there is a yes vote, you've got a very divided country to deal with, which doesn't realise how divided it is because it's had something else to look at for so long, which has distracted people from realising that the differences within Scotland are, say, far bigger than the differences within Yorkshire or within the West Midlands.
Thanks, Danny. One of the truisms of the day seems to be that the population's ageing. We're all living longer, etc. And that's very quickly been turned into a negative. It's going to cost the NHS, it's going to cost the care system, it's going to be turned around to be an attack on young people. The fact that some of us are getting older seems to be used as a blame for the problems of young people. So I'd be interested to see where you place ageing in your account of the UK's qualities and inequalities. And also, like, I think I'm very interested in the idea of intergenerational work, getting people to work together and perhaps have a more intergenerationally united community. There's more solidarity between the age groups rather than division.
Yeah. I mean, aging is a huge achievement. You know, it's often not put, you know, this is achievement, this is what you want. You know, maybe when people get 100, 105, 110, you could. Yeah, but we're a long, long, long way away from, you know, worrying about ageing too much. And the other thing about ageing is, as long as people are getting fitter as well, it's absolutely no problem. So we have our fittest 70-year-olds ever at the moment. Many of them are caring for 90-year-olds. And that's part of the intergenerational trends going on. So ageing is not a problem. There is a problem if you have a way of doing things because you have a younger population. And so that you stay in the family home forever. So if you've got people on their own staying in 4 or 5 bedroom houses, this creates problems because you've got a limited amount of space. But those things are very achievable, particularly achievable because the biggest mental health problem in the country is loneliness. And Asians increase the problem of loneliness, more people, particularly women, on their own. So you think you've got people on their own in houses and people who are lonely, something that could sort that out. But the other thing that helps reduce the immediate effects of ageing is to bring more younger people in. And that's, you know, that's immigration. And there's much less of a dislike of immigration up here. And there was in Sheffield. Sheffield had massive rates of immigration, which kept the city the same size. So the fifth largest Pakistani community in England. And that's we blew up quite a lot of town blocks in Sheffield. Nothing like the number that have gone up in Glasgow. But we would have demolished many more houses if we hadn't had young immigration. Currently we do have massive young immigration, but it's almost all coming into London and the South East. And London, the average age is going down and down and down. So it's becoming more imbalanced. And that isn't then having the effect of people sharing between generations.
Thanks, Danny. I wanted to ask a question about the economic period within in general on a global scale, because you mentioned that, of course, there's been big differences in the British economy over the last 100 years. Conservative commentators and so on often like to pretend that there's an absolute stability in society, that Britain's always been a kind of centre-right country, it's always been socially conservative. And I think this is one of the reasons why the yes votes come up in Scotland, not just because we have a national claim, so we have a vehicle for the referendum, but also because, a few people know this, Scotland actually has the largest public housing stock anywhere in Europe outside of the USSR by about the early 1960s, partly because it has such profound problems with poverty and social deprivation, so it led to a massive outlay for the new welfare state in Scotland. And I think the destruction of that has been a profound cultural shock. It's one of the reasons why people in Scotland have reacted badly to subsequent economic policy. But, and you said, you know, we could argue forever about why that turnaround in economic policy happened. But I think for a lot of people, we expected that the banking crash and the economic crisis in 2008 would represent, for neoliberalism, what something like the 1973 oil shock represented for Keynesianism, a moment where people could reevaluate and turn it all around. But it hasn't happened at all. I think it's also one of the reasons why the referendum's happened, because we need a plan B. We need something else we can do. So the housing bubble is reinflating. There's been almost zero reform of the banking system, despite this massive international calamitous crisis. I mean, the bankers must be absolutely laughing. They've committed this act of economic vandalism, which is almost without parallel in history, and literally nothing has been done to them at all. So can Scotland represent part of that shock moment if it moves into independence? But on a global scale, what's going to provide that opportunity? Because you said we need a big change and so on.
If you go back to the last big banking crash, which was 1929, there wasn't an immediate realisation the year after, or the next year after, or the next year after. There was 4 years in which bankers and Republicans in particular were trying to say, don't worry, it'll all come back to normal. And it really took throughout the 1930s for people to actually see it had changed. And that partly changed attitudes. Young people in the 1930s then went to war, came back never trusting big private business again because of what they were socialising. So there may still be a positive effect of 2008 that we may miss. You can see it sometimes. I can see it. And the kind of really good news is that we can't... It's a complicated one. Attitudes have changed. There's a quote about Keynes by a banker, Oswald Fox, who said what Keynes did, the general theory of whatever money was good, but the main thing that Keynes did is he changed the moral values of the times, what was seen as good. You do not see bankers being celebrated anymore for going drinking and buying champagne that costs £10,000 a bottle. You don't see that kind of thing anymore. You don't see the chairman of the BBC pay the kind of salaries they were paid. It's been marked. There's been a changing moral mood about what's right, what's decent, what's fair amongst a large number of the population. And when I say it's complicated, that's been so pervasive that we don't even notice it or celebrate it, because it's just normal not to be impressed by people making money. Now, if that was to continue, that is big, and it's big worldwide. But it's a slow and steady thing. Clive James, my favourite quote of it, who was ill at the time, is still ill. In January 2009, he wrote a piece saying that conspicuous consumption was about to go out of fashion in the same way that the cop piece did. Just as the cop piece doesn't come back. Now, he was calling it early, I think, because he was so ill and he wanted to say it. But if you go back to the 1929 moment, it took longer. But this message is generally seeping out and it's known about what happened. And it's the young bankers. I mean, these people are in their 30s who are working for 12, 16 hours a day, making lots of money. If you just Google the speeches of Andy Halpern, the deputy director of the Bank of England, he goes around doing speeches saying the world banking system is insecure and could crash at any moment. I mean, so senior bankers aren't worried. I think he partly does it so that he can say, look, I told you. So it's small. These are only 2,000 people. The people making over $1 million a year. This is just 2,000 people. And they can retire at 45 or 50. And they also think they're doing good. If you look at what Bob Dylan doesn't understand how much he was disliked or why he was disliked. He sees himself as a force for good. So it's a very small number of people who thought they were doing good. The mass of the population is not impressed. And I think that is slowly spreading amongst many people. Except I have to say, now I live back in the south of England, in the home counties, there's still an idea that a few people make money and most people are leeches. And you pay your taxes and it goes and stops them rioting and coming and burning your house down. But there are changes in attitudes going on, but they need to be fostered and grown. And people are shocked, including people at the top, by the rate of growth of inequality. To get the Sunday Times rich list year after year and see how the Queen is now position 70 or whatever, I generally wasn't predicted this was going to happen. And I think there is a change. The last thing I'll say on this is that we are becoming collectively poorer. And as part of the adaptation is going to be, how are we going to live with having less than we did have? Partly because we've had so much, because we exploited other countries quite well. And they've become clever at not being exploited. So there is a big adaptation that has to happen to all the rich countries of the world. And at the moment, the people at the top are trying to avoid adapting to it. That shortly after the crisis, the pound fell in value by 20%. Bankers increased their salaries by 20% just so they could stay level, so they could still afford to keep the property in various countries around the world. They didn't think they were being greedy. They needed a pound to fall by 20%. Thank you very much.